Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to This Miraculous Life, broadcasting and recording live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Oliveri Olumba, and this podcast is all about tuning in with the miraculousness of life and liberating yourself from the bullshit that gets in the way of that. That is why I started this podcast. We respond to letters, questions, comments, concerns about life every episode and try to share some insight that will help move the bullshit, the garbage, the distractions out of the way and allow us all to experience life more as what it truly is, which is a profound and miraculous gift. I have my master's degree in positive psychology. I am also a life coach in Washington, D.C. So I bring all of that to the show, as well as, of course, my own personal human opinions. And today we are responding to an important letter about confidence, as well as some other like pretty deep shit that you will hear that the person who wrote to us is going through. And we have one of the most special guests on the show today. Her name is Louisa Jewell, and she is not only a positive psychology and workplace well-being expert, but she has also written one of the books that is, I would say, honestly, my number one most recommended book to clients. Louisa, your book is the book that I recommend most often to my clients. It's called Wire Your Brain for Confidence. It's amazing. And also, Louisa happens to be one of my very favorite people in the world. We met because we actually both have the same master's degree in positive psychology. So we did not graduate the same year, but we became fast friends because I was drawn to her warm and authentic energy. So thanks for being here, Louisa.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I feel exactly the same about you, Sarah. I feel like when I met you, it was like, I have to be friends with this woman.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm so glad the feeling was mutual.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for just having me here today. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you here. I mean, from the time I started the show, I mean, I think you had already published your book before the show started. And I really have to say, Louisa, I love your book. And I mean it when I say that I recommend your book to clients more than I recommend any other book, because your book is just so practical. And it talks about issues that almost everyone struggles with to some extent. And what I really love about it is that it has exercises almost every chapter so that people, you know, I love reading positive psychology books. That's obviously what I studied, but I feel like a lot of them inform us, but don't really tell us how to apply the science to our own lives. We kind of have to figure that out for ourselves, which is, as a life coach, I think part of my job. But what I love about your book is that I think people can actually benefit from using your book, even if they are not working with a professional life coach.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, thank you. I tried to make it that way. You know, I really struggled myself with confidence and with self-doubt. I had definitely had chronic self-doubt. And, you know, through doing my master's degree at the University of Pennsylvania and learning all of those incredible tools around how to build a more action-oriented kind of confidence, I really wanted to share all of that and let people know. So I think the book really is just kind of like me sitting on the sofa next to you, kind of just sharing my experiences And letting people know that, you know, I had it too, and there are ways that you can overcome it for sure.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. No, I loved hearing that from you. So
thank you.
I'm so excited to have your help responding to this really important letter that we've received. And as always, Alexia Brown, our phenomenal studio engineer, is here. Hi, Alexia.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks.
Hi, Alexia.
For being here. As always. So are you guys ready to hear this letter?
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay, so let's hear it. And then we'll dive in to, you know, our thoughts and Luisa's expertise. Okay, here's what our writer says. Dear Sarah, after taking 2 years off work to care for my sick mother and mourn her death, I have recently rejoined the workforce. I am just trying to get back to normal and feel like the confident, happy young person I should be. But to be honest, I am struggling. My mother had always been a source of strength for me, and I feel like as she grew weaker, so did I. It seems like I no longer have the spirit and confidence that I used to, both at work and socially. Even though my work environment is friendly and inclusive, sometimes I feel paralyzed at work. Apparently, this lack of confidence at a new job is known as the imposter syndrome. And it is not entirely unusual. I am working as an administrative assistant, and I had hoped this job would just be a stepping stone to something more creative, but at the moment, I am feeling overwhelmed. My main tasks include planning the boss's schedule, informing clients about our product packages, and email and phone correspondence. It should be pretty straightforward, but each time I take a call or send the boss her daily schedule, I have a brief moment of panic. I'm invited to join meetings, and like everyone else, I'm encouraged to share my weekly learning or suggestions, but I never do. This lack of confidence also seems to be creeping into my social life. Just last week, I joined some friends for game night, which I always used to love, but now being put on the spot for an answer makes me extremely anxious, and I realize that I don't enjoy the night much at all. Somehow, I feel uncomfortable in my own skin, even just hanging out with some of my best friends. Have you ever heard of someone experience gradual vanishing confidence like this? I don't want this to be my new normal. I want to be happy and confident, ready to learn and grow. What can I do to conquer this nervousness? How can I find my old spirit and improve my work and social experiences? Sincerely, Confidence Collapse.
Heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. I almost cried a little bit on that, that first paragraph when she said, but to be honest, I am struggling. I think that that's really, I think we've all felt that way at some time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And so normal to feel that way.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I think I would love to honestly just check in with you right away, Luisa, because not only do you have a wealth of expertise on this subject, but I know that you may, and I don't know what you're willing to share, but I know that you may be able to even personally relate to some of the experiences that this writer has shared. So I would love to just hear your authentic, immediate reaction to this letter.
Well, my immediate reaction, again, was how heartbreaking.
Right.
And, you know, if this person is listening, confidence collapse. When I read that too, I thought, oh my gosh. Mm. And, you know, when you take 2 years off work to care for a sick mother, and again, if this person is listening, I'm so sorry to hear about the passing of I think it's a her. Do we know if it's a her or a him? I think
we do not know for sure.
Okay. So to care for a sick mother, I think I did that as well for a few years. I had a lot of help doing that, which was really good. I'm also now going through a situation where I'm the primary caregiver for my ex-husband, who's suffering with an inoperable brain tumor right now. And it is heartbreaking. It's really heavy. I was talking to a friend this morning and saying that when you go through an experience like that, you try to be joyful. You have moments where, you know, I celebrated an early Easter with 40 friends on Saturday. It was a really nice afternoon. Mm. But the sadness of taking care of someone you love, it seems to always be with you.
Right.
You know, as a caregiver, because you love this person so much. So I think just getting over 2 years of that can be quite a struggle to maintain your mental well-being. And so it becomes much more difficult, I think, to be confident and vibrant and energetic when you've been in that kind of sadness for such a long time.
Mm.
And so I would say to this person, take some time, you know, and it looks like he or she has taken some time to mourn their death, which is good. You know, give yourself that space to be able to get back on your feet and feel that joy again and be able to say goodbye in a good way and to allow yourself those feelings. I know sometimes I go to hot yoga for an hour and I cry on the mat and nobody knows because I'm sweating so much. So then I just
blends right in with the sweat.
Blends right in. And then I wrap, you know, I roll up my mat and I go home. But I allow myself that time to get those feelings out rather than, you know, trying to suppress my feelings. I allow myself time to be able to deal with those feelings. So that in itself is difficult. But, you know, if I want to focus this conversation on confidence, there's something that she said in there. She said, my mother had always been a source of strength for me, and I feel like as she grew weaker, so did I.
Yeah, that stood out to me, too. I wasn't totally sure what to make of it.
Yes, and so to me, and that to me was kind of a clue, because I think this person is giving away their confidence to their mother and saying, you know, my source of strength was my mother, and she's gone now, so is my source of strength.
Mm.
And now I don't know if that's exactly how they feel, but if that's the belief that, you know, I now have to live my life without this source of strength, then that's a real belief. And in the confidence research and literature, your beliefs make a huge, huge difference to your confidence level, because beliefs become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Mm.
So if now I believe that this source of strength is vanished off the earth, and how could I ever have it back without this person?
Right, and she used the word vanishing,
Right?
Yeah, gradually vanishing confidence.
Yes, that's right. Then I'm going to believe that, and I'm going to live my life that way.
Right.
So instead, if I can change that belief, and here's a few things. You know, your mother's source of strength is not gone, because in fact, her greatest source of strength is what she taught you about life.
Mm.
It is her example that she set for you. She was a source of strength because you watched her and how she dealt with things. And she gave you those gifts that will never leave you.
Right.
Your mother and her gifts and what she taught you about strength will never, ever leave you. That's instilled inside of you.
Mm.
That's not gone just because she's not physically here on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how people feel about this, how spiritual they are, but when both my mother and my father, and I had a dear aunt as well who died at 96, I had such a connection with my aunt. These people were, you know, loved me so much. But when they died, I didn't feel that they left me.
Mm.
I still feel like they're you know, whether you want to call it in heaven or in the universe or somewhere, I still feel like they're looking down on me and supporting me and giving me strength. And I still reach out to them and say, you know, I say to my mom, we always say, my mom was very religious, and we always say she had a direct line to God, right?
Wow.
And then I thought, and then I thought, if she's in heaven somewhere, then, you know, she's got an even greater
direct line,
you know, even better. So now when I really have rough times, and she always had that poem, and again, this is very religious. I'm not a religious person, but I am a very spiritual person. And my mom always had this poem at the front door about Jesus was walking along the shore with someone, and he was watching the footsteps, and he noticed in his life that there was only one set of footprints when he was going through a hard time. And he said to Jesus, why did you abandon me in the roughest times of my life? And Jesus responds and says, no, that's when I carried you.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so when I go through those times, I love that. I love that prayer. And sometimes I say to my mom, look, Mom, I need you to carry me right now.
Right.
Like I can't do this right now by myself. I need you to carry me. And then I just feel this source of strength, this beautiful, spiritual, loving feeling. I just feel like, yep, I've got these powerful people that are, you know, up above and able to give me that strength at that time.
So I have two questions, because that resonates so much with me. I don't consider myself religious because I don't associate with any particular religion, but I do consider myself to be deeply spiritual and have a relationship with something that is God. I do call it God, but I don't think that that's a necessity by any means.
Yeah.
I don't really care what the name is. It could be the spirit of the universe, whatever. But I have two questions. One is, Louisa, this shifting to this belief that just because your parent, your mom, is no longer physically here doesn't mean that she is not still a source of strength for you. Did you feel that immediately with your own mom, or is that something that took time to arrive at? And if so, like, how did you get there? And then my second question is, what are your thoughts, and I can think about this together as well, about translating that into something that can be tapped into even if somebody is not spiritual?
Well, I see, for me, it happened right away. And in fact, when my dad died, I felt him even more powerfully.
Wow.
I don't know why. But let's put that aside, because you're right. Some people are not spiritual or into that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take a look at this from a scientific perspective.
Mm-hmm.
She needs to change their belief that just because mom is gone, I have lost my strength.
Mm, right.
I have lost my source of strength. That you have to ask yourself, so there's good questions you can ask yourself. Is that true?
Mm.
Is that true?
Is it true that just because mom is gone, my source of strength has disappeared?
Right.
Right.
Is that true? And we can challenge those thoughts by saying, you know, actually, I'm a strong person. I cared for her for 2 years.
Right.
And now I'm back at work. I'm pretty strong.
Right.
You know, or
look for the evidence.
Look for the evidence that you're a strong person. Or I saw my mom go through this, and she taught me, you know, perseverance, or she taught me forgiveness, or she taught me, you know, whatever she taught you, that actually, that's still with me.
Absolutely.
I have the evidence of that, because just the other day I did this and this.
Right.
So find the evidence that counterbalances and says, you know, and so the belief you really want to have is, you know, just because my mom is gone doesn't mean that I don't have her source of strength.
Right.
And then find the evidence around why that is true. And I think that will shift
right.
the person's beliefs into something that is much more productive,
right.
you know, for her. Because once we get these things in our head, I'm telling you, it can just be self-fulfilling prophecy and you're going down a rabbit hole.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this, in my sort of life coach speak, this sounds to me like changing limiting beliefs.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And in the confidence realm, that's where it starts. If you really believe something, it's probably going to come true.
Mm.
So you have to shift your belief in order for you to get there. And finding evidence for why what you're thinking is not true
mm-hmm.
is one of the best ways to change those beliefs.
Mm. So it sounds like the steps are identify that a belief might be limiting you, like it might not be serving
yes.
you.
And yes.
once you identify that, really ask yourself, is this belief a fact? And if not, what is the evidence that it might be false?
Yeah.
And
exactly.
then think about, you know, what if it is not, you know, a hard and fast fact, which by the way, no belief is,
right.
that this is true, then what else might be true that
Good.
Would
yeah,
actually
I love it.
Serve me more?
I love it.
To focus on. And then that's where you said, you know, there's an alternative belief, or sometimes in coaching, I call it, a colleague of mine introduced me to calling it a freeing belief. And
love it.
Yeah. And it sounds like what you're suggesting is, for example, in this particular situation, a freeing belief could be, even though my mom is no longer here with me, all of the strength that she instilled in me still is.
Yes, love it.
And then looking for evidence that the freeing or the alternative belief is true.
Yeah, and look, she cared. Sorry, I keep saying she. But
that's okay. I've been making the same mistake. Yeah.
Yeah, they cared for their mom.
Right.
That's strong. That takes a huge amount of strength.
Right.
To be a primary caregiver for somebody.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so step one is to address the limiting belief and
yeah.
find the evidence that it's not necessarily true. Find out what else might be true, and then find the evidence for that. And then I think the last step, as I understand it, is every time the limiting belief crops up, to remember the freeing belief and to ask yourself, what would be different in this moment if I were to focus on this other belief?
Exactly. Exactly.
That
yeah.
is so helpful, Louisa. That is so
yeah.
helpful.
Good.
So I want to check in with Alexia, actually. Alexia, any thoughts about this conversation, about this letter, about the identifying when you're having a belief that is limiting you, and then the process that Louisa walked us through for being able to liberate yourself from that belief?
Sure. I think it's very critically important. I've noticed that perhaps when people go through a loss and they lose someone who means a lot to them, like the awkward part is like, how long do I grieve for, and how long do I like have to hold myself in this space where I feel like I'm suffering and like I feel like I'm at a loss? I know that's something that I've dealt with recently. And so I don't know if that resonates with anyone, but I think it's very helpful to recognize that the person that you are grieving for, you can see them supporting your strength and your like empowerment and well-being in different ways. So what you were saying earlier about the spiritual side of things and seeing the positive side of it and how you're still connected to those people, that resonates with me. But I also think that switching your belief is incredibly important, just because you're still here, you're still alive, you're still moving through life. So you might as well try to retain and keep moving with life and keep moving with confidence. So switching that belief, I think, is very important, and just like not letting yourself suffer longer or
yeah.
in ways that you don't need to.
That's awesome, Alexia. Yeah. And I know that, I'm glad you said that, Alexia, because the truth is, like, I didn't want to say it because I have not lost, like, any, I've not lost anyone in a tragic or surprising way. You know, really the only person close to me who has passed away is my grandfather, and he was 93, and he had an amazing, you know, it was difficult, but like, can't ask for too much more than that, you know? Yeah. But one of the, I have experienced some like pretty tremendous betrayals and like difficult things happening with family members that I love. I've experienced some hard shit. And I think one of the experiences I've had that I've shared with clients, and I think Louisa kind of brought it up when she was talking about going through years of such sadness. You know, when I was going through those things, I kind of had this feeling that I was supposed to be really sad and depressed and basically like, you know, void of joy. Like, how can you be, how can you be here laughing and like appreciating something about life when this terrible thing has just happened to you? And so what I noticed myself doing during those times was that I would almost like, I would feel myself starting to enjoy something or like feel happiness or feel gratitude or like light up a little bit. And I would, it's almost like this imaginary thing in my head would be like, what are you doing, Sarah? This is not the time for that. You know, you are supposed to be grieving. You are supposed to be devastated. Yeah. Like, stop that, you know? And yeah. I really had to make a conscious effort to not stop it, to like allow myself to lean in and feel like allow the happiness to stay there and be there. But the thing that I thought was really interesting, which was unexpected, was that even if like 75% of the day was really hard, the happy, joyful moments would show up all on their own. But the part that I had to work at was not falling into the belief that like that is not an appropriate emotion for me to be having right now. So like, why would I give myself permission to do that? And putting the happiness that has like arrived in my mind away because it feels inappropriate or feels like I'm not suffering enough. I'm Louisa, does that resonate at all with you or you, Alexia?
Absolutely. That resonates with me. It just happened this morning. A friend came over. She had these tickets that she can't use to this exciting thing, and she was giving them to me, and I thought that was so nice, and I was so happy. And I was going to say something about what's going on, and then I thought, no.
Right.
So it's true. Like, I felt like I had to be sad. And then I, you know, in that moment, I was just able to say, no, I'm just going to enjoy these few moments of happiness. This is so nice, you know.
Exactly.
But it's true. It's almost like you feel guilty or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you feel guilty, you know, that you have to be grieving all the time, right?
Yeah, because, you know, in my mind, you know, those things, it wasn't a loss. It wasn't a loss of a life. But I know that in my mind, I thought, when this happens to me, this is how it's going to be. And then it happened. And I was like, wait, why am I not curled up in a ball on the floor of my apartment? Why did I just have a moment where I felt joy over something like the wind on my face? And I would sort of tell my initial reaction or my instinct was to remind myself that this was not my current reality, right? To remind myself, it was almost like the happiness would arrive and then my brain would assume that the happiness had made a mistake and it forgot what was happening in my real life. And so then I would be I would say to myself, oh, you must have forgotten that this is your current reality. And so therefore, go away, happiness. This is not the time for you. But eventually I realized if these moments are making their way into my consciousness, why would I send them away? That's crazy. So I don't know if the person who wrote this letter, if he or she or they are experiencing any of those moments, but I do find that most people have even the smallest inkling of those when they feel joy or even peace, any positive emotion just for a moment. And I think that when we've experienced something that is exceptionally difficult, we tend to send those emotions away because we have a belief that there's no space for them in our current reality. And what I would say to that is, if the emotions found their way to you, then they want you to have them.
Yeah. Now, there's something else that I wanted to talk about in the letter.
Yes,
as
please.
Well. Okay. So one of the things she said here too, one of the things they said in the letter is that sometimes I feel paralyzed at work. And another thing that they said is, but each time I take a call or send the boss her daily schedule, I have a brief moment of panic. So I think what is happening is she has such a high level of anxiety, and we can have this high level of anxiety when we have chronic self-doubt. Now, I think when you are back at work after 2 years, it is normal for you to lack confidence because you've been out of work for 2 years. And she says it's not unusual. It's true. It is not unusual for you to lack confidence in your work because you've been away.
Right.
But she's not just lacking confidence at work. It's in her personal life. It's everywhere. Because a little bit of self-doubt is okay to say, geez, I really don't know what I'm doing in this job yet. That's normal because she's new to the job and, you know, back at work after 2 years. But when we see this kind of lack of confidence at work and personal kind of all the time, that's kind of a sign that she may be, they may be in chronic self-doubt.
And so if he is in chronic self-doubt, what is the difference between that and just normal self-doubt?
Well, if it's so, first of all, let's just say that it's normal for them to be feeling some lack of confidence in their new job. But when they question everything, and that's more chronic self-doubt, then that means that you are just questioning everything in your life and feeling anxious about making a mistake, about doing something wrong. So the question I ask, when this person, when they have a brief moment of panic, they have to ask themselves, what is it? What is causing the panic? Like, for example, when I take the time, but each time I take a call or send the boss her daily schedule. So what is the panic about? Do you think you made a mistake with the schedule? Do you think you didn't answer the call right? What is causing the panic? You know, because, you know, you could say, oh, you know, I've got my hand on the burner, on a hot burner, but I don't want to feel the heat. Well, you've got to really understand what's causing that heat. Like, what is the cause of the panic?
Interesting.
What are you saying to yourself in that moment? Because I say, if you can't name it, you can't tame it. So you have to ask yourself, maybe the person is saying, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if I did the schedule right. I think I made a ton of mistakes, and now she's going to think I'm an idiot because I made all these mistakes. And my best answer to that is, you first of all say, what is it? Do you feel like you've made a mistake? So first of all, identify what it is you're saying to yourself. And then talk yourself off the ledge. And there's a few ways of doing that. First of all, I say, So what if I made a mistake? I've only been on this job. I don't know. Do they say I think they've been on the job a few months? I don't know. But I've had new assistants many times. I've had new, you know, assistants. They make mistakes because they don't know what they're doing yet. They don't understand my rhythm yet. They don't understand all the systems.
Right.
So if they make a mistake, I go, yeah, normal. Let's hear. I'll just let them know, you know, what's going on here and what, how we normally do things. And they go, oh, okay, thank you. And then they never do it again.
Right.
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 So, you know, I'm sure the boss is probably not as hard on this person is,
sounds
you know,
like it. Yeah.
Right. So the first answer is, well, so what if I make a mistake? It's going to be fine because I'm new to this role and I'm just learning, and I will let them know, thank you. I learned from this mistake. It will never happen again. And that's it.
Mm.
Let it go. Mm. Right. And also to have a little bit of self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have self-compassion and we can say, you know, for some reason we seem to think we can't make mistakes, that we have to be perfect right out of the gate.
Right.
Right? So I haven't been working for 2 years and I just started a new job and I have to be perfect day one. Sorry. It's probably not going to happen.
Correct.
So why do you think, like, your boss probably doesn't expect that? Why would you expect that out
right.
of yourself? We're so much harder.
Can I,
on ourselves.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
One of the exercises that I learned from you, Louisa, that I feel like relates with what you're talking about is the mean coach, friendly coach exercise.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
Understanding that what the mean coach does is often a known cognitive distortion.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, the mean coach is somebody who's really just kind of, when you make a mistake, just kind of calling you names, telling you how terrible you are,
from
being really derogatory.
Yeah.
From in your own head.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, who's following you around?
Mm-hmm.
This mean person who's yelling at you all the time and telling you how useless you are.
Like berating you.
Right.
Blowing
or,
things out of proportion.
Right.
Worrying
or
all the time.
Right. Or a wise coach that says, okay, that wasn't your best effort.
Mm-hmm.
Or the wise coach that says, okay, you made a mistake. Yeah, you screwed up. All right, what can we learn from this?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do different?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you restore this with your boss. Let them know, yep, you caught the error. You're going to fix it. You're not going to do it again. Right?
Right.
So that's what you can do, right? That's what you can do. You can just say, you know, you can say, sometimes we think we have to be really hard on ourselves to get better at things. And that's not actually true. And in
right.
fact, the self-compassion research shows that when we are more self-compassionate, we actually do better. We're more confident. We perform better when we are, you know, self-compassionate.
Right.
So we think we need to be hard on ourselves, but you can be a positive, constructive self-criticizer without the beating up part. We can still say, yep, how can I do things better? How can I do things differently next time?
Right.
And we can learn from those experiences.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think for me, it was really powerful to understand the cognitive distortion piece and that this is kind of a known psychological phenomenon. And that there are names for common cognitive distortions and to sort of personify that voice, like you personified it as the mean coach. Because I do think that at times in my personal life, when I've ruminated or panicked, felt really not nervous beforehand, because I think, you know, something else I would say to this writer is that nervousness is natural. There's nothing wrong with nervousness. It's not even necessarily a thing that needs to be eliminated. And I think understanding that can be very liberating.
Yeah.
But I know that I've fallen into the trap of like doing a talk and I feel like I made one mistake. And then in order to quote unquote, make sure that I avoid making that mistake again, I'll replay it in my mind let's say 1,000 times, just every time focusing in a little bit. Imagine a camera that's like zooming in until you can see the hairs inside of your nose on that tiny mistake, and telling myself the story that I blew it. And telling myself that story because in my mind, I think that that will prevent me from blowing it again. But instead, all it does is just cause me to feel terrible and not get sleep in the meantime. And I think learning that there's a name for these things and they are actually not useful to my performance allowed me to believe that that was true. Whereas before, I would tell myself, no, it's true that if I just replay this mistake in my mind over and over again, I will actually perform better in the future. But then I read about the cognitive distortions and, you know, there were names for them, like black and white thinking, which means when you do something and you make one mistake and then you tell yourself the story that the whole thing was bad, right? Yeah. Or mind reading, when somebody does some behavior towards you that may seem a little bit off to you, and but you really truth don't know what it's about, and then you tell yourself the story that this person doesn't like you or that they're unhappy with your performance, or what are the personalization, which is a little bit similar to mind reading but not exactly. Like if the clerk at the grocery store is rude to you or short with right. you tell yourself the story that it's something you did that they were unhappy with, when really it could just be something that's going on in their personal life that has absolutely nothing to do with you.
Or you know what is another one? Should statements.
Right.
Right? Like, this person could also be saying, I should be good at this.
Mm.
I should be know how to do the daily schedule.
Right.
So if I make a mistake, there's something wrong with me,
mm-hmm.
you know? And shoulds are really just these standards that we put on ourselves. It can be completely unreasonable standards.
Right.
You know, I've just eliminated should out of my vocabulary. And so you're right. There are ways that we cognitively distort things that happen, and it's hard to describe it in just a few minutes. But there's, you know, in my book, I go through what are some of these cognitive distortions mm-hmm. and how you can overcome them. I think people don't realize what you say to yourself before you're about to do something, or after you've done something and you kind of have a disappointing performance, that it's so critical to get a handle on your self-talk.
Absolutely.
It is just so critical to do that.
Well,
and people don't realize how important it is to reprogram your self-talk.
Well, and something you say that I think is really liberating, because I know for me and many of my clients, the idea of totally reprogramming my self-talk is very intimidating, sometimes to the point of frustration or feeling like it's useless. But something that you write about that is very valuable to me is that when you first start noticing your cognitive distortions and your mean coach, the best that you can do is add in a secondary voice that just questions that first voice or points
exactly.
out the distortions. It's not realistic to think that you're going to eliminate the cognitive distortions or eliminate the mean coach. But if you can add a follow-up question, that will change your life.
Exactly. But you know what? If you do it long enough, if you challenge long enough,
yes,
that mean voice will go away.
Well, yeah, eventually go away. Absolutely.
Yeah. It takes a while.
Right.
It took me, I would say, a year or two.
Yes.
But now I don't have the mean voice anymore.
Mm.
Now I have the most compassionate, wisest coach now as my first voice.
That's awesome.
Because I've practiced and trained.
That's awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. And I also know that my clients often get frustrated because they're like, it's still there. It's still there. And I'm like, don't even worry. I don't even care if it's still there. Because if you are asking this second question, then that's enough for now, you know?
Yes.
So I like the idea of people just letting it leave if and when it chooses to leave. This has been amazing, Louisa. We have to wrap up, but I want to summarize the key wonderful advice that has been given out. The first one that stands out to me is this idea of identifying when you're having a limiting belief, which in the case of this person who has so generously shared their story, a limiting belief may be that when their mother passed away, so did their source of strength, and that source of strength is gone. And so identifying our limiting beliefs, questioning them, finding the evidence against them, identifying what a alternative freeing belief would be, finding the evidence for that. And then every time we feel this limiting belief coming up, reminding ourselves of the freeing belief. The second thing that stands out is this idea of if and when positive emotion finds you, let it find you. Simple as that. No matter how appropriate it seems, if it found you, it wants you to have it. The third thing, I thought this was really great, I'm going to use this, Louisa, is when you find yourself panicking, ask yourself, where is this panic coming from? What is the cause? Because if you don't know the cause, then you can't really address it.
You can't name it, you can't tame it.
If you can't name it, you can't tame it. That's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah.
Thank you. And then the last thing is this idea of shifting your self-talk and calling out when your self-talk is really mean and nasty, and really educating yourself about what cognitive distortions are and which ones you may be engaging in, and then introducing a second voice into the mental conversation that you have, maybe calling that the wise coach, and questioning the things that the mean coach are saying, dispelling those distortions, offering a more compassionate, but not only more compassionate, also a more balanced and realistic voice in your mind to talk about how you're doing in your life. Did I get them all?
Yeah. Beautiful. Love it.
Wow. Yeah. Any last things you want to add, Louisa?
Well, I think the other one that I wanted to say is to be able to say, so what, once in a while, you know?
So what, like, if you make a mistake?
Yeah. Like when you're with your friends and you know, they talked about this being in games night. So what if you say the wrong thing?
Right. Right.
So what if your answer is, you know, your friends love you.
Right.
Your friends love you. They could care less if you got the answer wrong to some game night, you know, answer. And even if you get it wrong, they're still going to love you.
Yeah.
They're your friends can be your greatest source of joy and confidence.
And it sounds what is something that the wise coach would say to you.
So what? You know what? And to say to yourself, okay, Louisa, you said a stupid answer. So what?
Mm-hmm.
You're a smart person. You just didn't know the answer to that stupid game night answer. But who cares?
I think that was a great illustration, Louisa, of what the wise coach conversation looks like. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Sarah.
Thank
this
you
has been
for being
great.
Here. Yeah,
and I hope we've helped this confidence collapse get, you know, confidence right back up again.
I hope so too. I hope so too.
Yeah.
And yeah, this was phenomenal. I know that you have even more tips, so I hope to have you back sometime in the future, Louisa. But you were amazing, and thank you for sharing your own story. Thanks for listening, you guys, and have a miraculous day.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.